This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that I turned one of my first homes into an Airbnb? It's true. And it even helped me get the extra income I needed to launch my real estate career. So if you want to try your hand at making even more income with your property, Airbnb is the place to be. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Are you about to sell a property? Wait like 60 seconds because this could save you thousands. Our friends at 1031 Pros have saved their clients more than $500 million, with a B, in taxes with 1031 tax-deferred exchanges. With the 1031 exchange, you can say goodbye to the huge capital gains taxes when selling and roll your property's profit into another investment that can make you even more. Whether you're an individual investor, part of a larger group, or a title or real estate agent, 1031 Pros is ready to help. Trust me, I've done 1031 exchanges on multiple properties before, and it has saved me tens of thousands in taxes, if not more. With over 30 years of experience, 1031 Pros has handled over 20,000 audit-free exchanges, and they specialize in all types of exchanges: delayed, simultaneous, reverse, and improvement exchanges in all 50 states. And right now, Bigger Pockets listeners can get $250 off any exchange by visiting my1031pros.com/BP. That's my1031pros.com/BP to get $250 off today. Oh, and make sure to mention Bigger Pockets when you call. They take care of our people over there.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED lights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
This is the Bigger Pockets Podcast, show number 275.
You don't always have to know everything before you actually get the deal. And there is actually time to research it. And sometimes if it doesn't pan out, you find something you don't like and the seller won't work with you, or if you want to cancel the deal, then you cancel it. You know, you don't have to bat 100% on your offers either. So if, like I said, if it was a 1 in 10, I got an accepted contract, there are probably 20% of those deals that I also canceled too. So it is a numbers game. And each deal that you cancel, you're going to have learned something.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com. Your home for real estate investing online.
What's going on, everyone? This is Brandon, today's host of the Bigger Pockets Podcast, here with my wonderful, awesome co-host, Mr. David Green. How you doing, David?
I'm doing great, man. How is Hawaii treating you?
Hawaii is treating me well. I got one more month here, and then everyone will be able to stop listening to me talk about how awesome Hawaii is. So we're heading back in May.
You're buying a house, right? You're trying to buy something and move out there permanently?
Well, I'm exploring the idea, or at least having a property, like a second plot property I can rent out when I'm not there and I can go back and forth. That would kind of be ideal. So I put an offer on a house last week, actually, or was it 2 weeks ago now? And, you know, we're in negotiations. I actually don't think it's going to go through, but as we talk about in today's show, that's fine. This is a numbers game. I'm not emotionally attached to it. I was a little emotionally attached, but I'm not that emotionally attached. Like if they end up accepting my offer, it's going to be a great deal as an investment property, even in Hawaii, which people say it's impossible to find. It's not. But if they don't take it, I'm going to keep looking.
That's how the master buys real estate.
That's the master real estate strategy. No, it really is. And we talk about that in today's show, that like our guest talks about how 90% of his offers get rejected, you know, and that's kind of about my number too. I typically lose about 90% of my offers, and he talks about why that doesn't matter. But before we get to today's show, I don't want to talk too much about it. I want to get to today's quick tip. Now, today's quick tip is, I want to tell you guys a little bit about Bigger Pockets Landlord Forums. If you are a real estate investor who owns rental properties, or you plan to, you need to pick up some of our landlord forums. We have currently 34 different states that we have landlord law, like, you know, specifically a state. State specific landlord forms that have been looked at and prepared by other like attorneys in those states, which is super cool. There's 8 different documents, including a 12-page lease, an application, addendums, etc. And it's like way more comprehensive and way more legal than you're going to find like some free form online. So like, as you'll hear today on today's show, having a good lease is so important. In fact, our guest today tells a story about how, you know, you can lose like 15 grand if you would just have the wrong lease. So don't have the wrong lease. It's like not that expensive to buy the leases on BiggerPockets. I think right now where there's a sale, you can get it for like $100. I don't know when that sale ends. So pick it up today, biggerpockets.com/LLForms. And with that, let's get on with today's show. So DG, today we're talking with a lawyer. That's always fun, right? Talking with lawyers.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I wake up every morning and I'm upset if I don't have a lawyer to talk to. I know the day is going to be boring because I don't have any legal advice, but
there you go.
They're kind of like vegetables, right? Like nobody really wants to learn the law or talk to lawyers or eat vegetables, but you need to do it. It's good for you. It's healthy. So you just go through with it. And then when you're done, you're like, I actually feel really, really good. And I'm ready to go take on whatever I have coming up next. So I'm a big fan of learning as much as I can. And when it's a topic that's really boring that I don't enjoy learning, I enjoy listening to someone else give me kind of like the quick condensed version that I can learn from there. Much like these forums on BiggerPockets, I'm really not going to want to have to go try to figure out how do I draw up a bulletproof lease. I just want to click a button on BiggerPockets because someone who likes that boring stuff, some vegetable eater, has already made it for me and I can just go get it from them. So this show is actually, it's very entertaining, right? It's a good show. I'm not trying to say it's not. It's great. But where else can you find a lawyer where you can actually be entertained while listening to them?
Yeah.
That's what's awesome, right?
Yeah, because he's got an awesome story. Like, we don't sit there and drill him on like legal stuff all day. Like, it's not like a, but we talked to this guy today. His name's Rob Oliver, and he's an attorney that he like just like, happened to go from like one like condo to 300 condos like in a short period of time. And he like, I don't even think he realizes how awesome that is. Like, he's just like, it's just what I did. Like, what's the big deal? But you guys are going to love this story. Again, Rob Oliver is amazing. Lots of good advice in there about like being a landlord, about buying rental property, about why condos might need us. You know, like I've shied away from them, but after talking with Rob now, I'm like, man, maybe I should have looked more into them and maybe I should.
I know. I was thinking right? that too.
Yeah. I'm like, this is cool. So anyway, he's got a super cool story. But again, today's show is with Rob Oliver, an attorney from the Chicago area who went from like, you know, buying nothing or having nothing to like 300 condos. And he talks about his journey there today. So with that, let's get to the interview. Oliver, welcome to the Bigger Pockets podcast. Good to have you here. How you doing?
What's up, guys? How are you?
Good, good. This should be a lot of fun today. And I will be honest, I know pretty much nothing about you whatsoever. So we're going to start very early in your journey. Tell us about yourself. How'd you get into real estate?
All right, sure. Yeah, I've got an uncle that is a real estate lawyer and owns a title insurance company. So after being a caddy at the golf course for about 7 or 8 summers, I graduated high school and my uncle says, hey, listen, why don't you come work at a real job and stop carrying golf bags around? So I showed up to his title company and, you know, rolled in the door, saw a couple of real estate closings go on and quickly got assigned some duties as a clerk, paying water certificates and recording deeds and kind of like an assistant around the title company for a summer. And, you know, it's one of those things, it's like a full transformation. You see the lawyers, you see the brokers, the buyers, the sellers, they all walk in and they're all walking out, you know, smiling or yelling and they've got big checks and wire transfers are coming in. So it was a nice welcome change.
Okay.
So I did that for, you know, I worked my way up to a closing agent at a title company and did that on like summers and holiday breaks from college. And then I also, after college, I ended up going to law school. I got a degree in college in real estate finance. And then I was pretty interested after seeing all the lawyers come through the title company. So I enrolled in law school and, you know, I had a job as a closing agent and I worked as a real estate broker in law school. And was pretty fortunate to be able to pay cash for law school, not have any loans. And I kind of had my own sort of internship instead of working at a big law firm. So it was a good learning experience and paid pretty well and kind of got me going as a real estate lawyer. And it was a nice head start.
Okay. Okay. So you went from lawyer to eventually investor, correct?
Correct.
So walk us through that transition. Like how long did that take and like, why did you decide to make that jump?
Yeah, sure. So the practice I started at was, again, the same uncle that owned the title company, owned a law firm. So small firm, only 4 lawyers. And I wasn't given a book of business when I walked in. He basically said, you eat what you kill. Here, whatever you bill, you can take half of. And the other half goes to the office for, you know, support staff, malpractice insurance, stuff like that. So, you know, I was on my own, and I linked up with some real estate brokers I knew and some other real estate clients. And, you know, I started practicing law. And for the most part, I was interested in doing real estate transactions. You know, I knew I wanted to become a real estate investor at some point in time, but, you know, I didn't have any money. I didn't have any experience investing in property. I certainly didn't know what the correct pricing of properties were. So I went about practicing law. It was 07. I got out of law school. And at the end of 2008, you know, I'd been practicing maybe a year and a half, and, you know, the recession hit and transactions came to a screaming halt. Prices were going down, and, you know, I had very little business. So I was kind of put in a situation where I needed to adjust and become a litigator, or I needed to find some other way to make money. And, you know, I stumbled upon a foreclosed condo with a gentleman who's now my business partner, and by happenstance found a deal that had the perfect fundamentals in terms of rental income, acquisition price. And, you know, it's sort of like the rest is history.
So, Rob, one thing I know is that lawyers make their living. They literally make their living by knowing everything there is to know possibly about what they're doing before they get involved, right? If they're like a trial lawyer, they know all of the law. They know the judge. They know the jury. They know exactly where they're going to go. Real estate investors don't get that luxury. A lot of the time we are learning as we're doing things, right? And sometimes we're only learning through doing things. Can you tell us how on earth you made that shift to get comfortable buying your first deal, what that first deal looked like, how it shifted your mindset getting into it, what that kind of journey was like on your first deal?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it definitely helped because I had a background in title, working at the title company. I understood how to research properties, how to go through the public records, which I would recommend to any new investor. If you're, you know, trying to get your feet wet and you want to get in there, just soak up as much information as you can. You know, the public records are, although you can find some things on, you know, Zillow or Redfin or these, you know, various websites out there, you know, I think they're somewhat inaccurate or you're not verifying the actual source. So, you know, what we did in terms of research is reviewed the public records in the recorder's office. So, you know, on the particular condo unit I'm talking about, we, you know, researched, I knew what it sold for before, I knew what it sold for before then, what year it was, what all the other units in the building were selling for. And it provides a good roadmap in comparison. So, you know, hey, here's what I'm getting into. I stand to make a good deal because my discount is this compared to the other units. And it sort of fell into place. But you can't just stumble around and say, oh, I'll just make an offer and, you know, I think I'll get lucky and I think it's a good price. But if you don't really know anything, you know, you're basically doing the same thing as if you're, you know, walking into the casino and playing a little blackjack. So, you know, in this particular unit, we ended up buying a condo. I paid $30,000 for it. It had previously sold about 5 years earlier. This is 09 when I bought it. And it sold in 04 or 05 for $140,000. So I'm thinking, wow, this is an incredible discount. You know, it was 20 cents on the dollar. Okay, so I'm thinking, okay, wow. If it goes lower than 30 grand, I'm, you know, the whole world is sort of done for, so it doesn't even matter. I'll just go with them. So my partner and I walked in, we made the offer, we got it. And I'm thinking, okay, now what do I do? We found a contractor, we paid some closing costs, finished the closing. So call it, I'm all in for 35 grand, had it rented for $650, you know, about a week later, and I ran the number. I said, okay, this is a 12% cap rate, you know, the cash on cash return. You know, assuming we pay cash for everything, it's 12%. I'm going, okay. So I'm getting a 12% yield on my money. I just bought for 20 cents on the dollar. These are good fundamentals. I just don't see what's going wrong. So that was a cool first deal. It was definitely small ball. It's not sexy or glamorous, but, you know, that's kind of why I attribute it to why it was such a good deal. No one wanted it. It was just a, you know, crappy little condominium. But
where was that? Where do you find a $30,000 condo?
Albany Park. It's in the, you know, a neighborhood of Chicago on the northwest side, working class neighborhood. You know, just at the time, it was not a favorable asset class, so it didn't trade for, you know, for a high number. But, you know, all the sharks and the sort of institutional money at that time were chasing after, you know, distressed apartment buildings that were selling at, call it, 80 or 100 grand a door, and also had like inferior finishes than what was a you know, an older or a converted condominium. So
okay, so if I hear you right, Rob, you took the knowledge that you had from working at a title company, which was kind of a unique set of knowledge that many people might not understand would help you with investing, but that's what you had. You dug in and you did a research of the history of this property, and you found that at the peak it had been selling for $160,000, and then it was listed at $40,000. You offered $30,000. Is that correct?
Yeah, $140,000 I think was the $140,000 sale price.
But, so you felt. You felt confident to jump in because you knew the history of this thing is crazy. It was so much high. This, you know, 30, 40 grand is a deal. And you knew it was a deal because you knew the history of the property.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. If you just walked up and looked at a listing and said, hey, this condo is listed for 40 grand. You're just thinking, okay, it's junk. What am I doing here? But, you know, you don't have the vantage point of knowing, hey, here's what it previously sold for. Oh, by the way, there's 30 other units in the building. Here's what they all previously sold for. Something's wrong here. You know,
yeah, that's really good.
Whether it's broker mismarketing or, you know, a lot of different variables as to why you can find the price. But, you know, just in general, it seems like you got to have some skill to bring to the investment table. Mine happens to be in, you know, title insurance and law, but, you know, whether you're a broker or a lender, just, you know, I think you have to have some kind of angle to approach the deals from. So you have, you know, you're not just an outsider, like, you know, it's the equivalent of looking at a stock and saying, oh, I like the way the Microsoft logo looks, or I like the way Google looks now. You don't know anything. You're just throwing darts at the board, right?
Yeah. So that's great. And I love that you said you have to have a skill. That's totally true. And not everyone needs the same skills. Some people can analyze a deal. Some people are great with finding other people and building relationships, and they can find someone that finds a deal. Some people are contractors and know how to estimate rehab costs. You know, there's all kinds of skills that you can have. You use the ones you had to get you to move forward. And then you said something else that was really interesting I want to dig in on. You mentioned that nobody else was looking for those deals. Institutional investors were looking for something much bigger. You were kind of flying under the radar going for these condos, and the rent you were getting was putting you at like the 2% rule, right?
Yeah, it was, you know, again, it was totally, you know, it was a random occurrence, but, you know, we fell into it, saw some of the fundamentals, and I said, hey, this is a good model. No one wants these, you know, like everyone's going right. So I just said, okay, we'll look left and see what we can do here. And, you know, it's not a sexy business model. It's not glamorous, but, you know, it was very programmatic, and I was able to replicate it over and over and over. And, you know, at the end of the recession, you know, with that same strategy, you know, I amassed about 300 condo units, buying them for the most part one at a time. You know, we did some small packages, but a lot of small dollar transactions.
Did you just say 300 condos?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
And they're probably spread out through, call it 250 different condo buildings.
Wow. So, all right. So I want to dig on condos, because like this is something that I've generally been avoiding in my investing, as condos, because condos freak me out a little bit because of HOAs. And I'm like, well, what if they raise the HOA fees, or what if they suddenly do this? But you're finding a lot of success with condos.
Right.
So, I mean, can you just alleviate my fears here? Like, am I justified in being afraid of condos? Am I just not focused on that, so I shouldn't get into it? Like, what do you have to say about condos?
Yeah, again, the investment world doesn't like them. That's and I think it creates opportunity, because there's gaps in that which make it inefficient. Like you just said, you think the average person that says, okay, I'm gonna buy a $200,000 condominium, I've saved up 20% to put down, now I've got a $160,000 mortgage. A working class person or someone living in that unit is also gonna be, you know, a big burden to pay a large special assessment. So I think if there's a whole building full of people that has to deal with this, I can deal with it too. It's not going to be totally detrimental. It may be a little bit of a cash flow hit, but a lot of times special assessments are financed over periods of time, or else I can attend a board meeting and you know, provide a contractor or provide some input as to what's going on. On the flip side, what you don't realize for a new investor, the condo association manages everything outside the primer of the unit. So, you know, from the walls out, I don't have to deal with roofs. I don't have to deal with shoveling. I don't have to deal with common areas, mowing lawns, any of that stuff. All I have to do is maintenance on the inside of the unit. So I pay a monthly assessment, which covers the insurance, covers the water, covers some utilities, and then overall management. So, you know, my calls from my tenants are, hey, I've got a plumbing issue, so I send a plumber. Turnover, I've got to send a painter. Otherwise, it's just general maintenance, or you send a pest guy to clean up bugs or whatever. So it really eliminates the size and the frequency of maintenance calls. And it just allows it to be very programmatic.
Okay.
Also, at the time of turnover, like on a single family house, you know, you could have a roof go out, you could have to paint the whole house, you could have structural issues. I don't have to get involved with any of that. I may have to pay if there's a special, but for the most part, you can underwrite these buildings and see if they've got reserves or a good board that's running it.
Yeah, okay, Rob, great. You said you went from buying that first condo, realized you had found something, and then somehow went from one condo for 30,000 to 300 units, right? So
that's amazing.
There's a whole lot that you learned in that process.
That's right. That's right.
That's incredible, right? Can you share with us a little bit about what that process would like? How did you fund these deals? How did you do this while working a full-time job? Did you put a team together? Like, give us some of an idea of how you structured this whole plan and what your thought process was where you said, I got a good thing. Let me multiply it times 100.
Yeah, sure. So like I said, the fundamentals were great on the first deal. We're at a 12%, cap rate, and I was buying at 20 cents on the dollar. So he said, okay, we need to do some more of this. So my business partner, I've got one business partner and I, we both have full-time jobs. He was working as a real estate broker and an acquisitions guy for a local larger scale investor who happened to be going bankrupt at that time. So he was looking for a little bit of a transition as well. Sort of replicated that first unit, not exact numbers, but very close. We did that about 30 times with friends and family money, which we would call up or, we got some people to take a leap of faith with us. We said, hey, we'll give you, I'll give you a first position mortgage on our condominium that we're purchasing. I want 100% loan to value, which was sort of wild. We did have a lot of trust from some friends and family, but I was paying 10% interest. I'd give them a first mortgage. And then once we get to the point where we had called 5 to 10 units aggregated, we'd find some local community banks that were willing to refinance based on appraised value. So we'd buy, rehab, rent them, and then we bring them a stabilized package saying, hey, we've got this much income. We'd like a first mortgage to cover all these. And then we'd use the mortgage proceeds to repay our investors and then sort of recycle the money and do that over and over. When we got to about 30 units, we realized we need to step it in gear. We need to move quicker. We couldn't recycle and refi fast enough and we weren't able to offer fast enough. So, we were coming in the office on Sundays at noon and leaving at 2 in the morning. And, we were just analyzing deals on paper, title, research of public records. We could determine how healthy the building was. And we'd look at pictures of the listing to see generally what it looked like. We'd look at the location on the map and we'd know pretty much what we needed. So on those Sundays, we'd put in, 100, 200 offers some days, strictly off MLS or through public listings that we saw. And, we were probably striking out 90% of the time, but, we were offering what we saw fit. We had a lot of angry responses from brokers, but, batting 10% was fine because we knew we were alleviating a lot of the risk and the deals we were buying were good fundamentals. But,
to jump in real quick, I think you said something super, super valuable here is that like you were striking out 90% of the time. A lot of people get into real estate and they're like, they make an offer and they don't get it accepted. And they're like all disheartened and they're like, oh man, I tried and they didn't take my offer or whatever. But like most investors I know typically will strike out 90% of the time, right? Like they lose over and over and over and over and over. Yet like I just think that's like a good testament to your like, I don't know what you call it, grit maybe. The fact that you like, if you're striking out 90% of the time, that also means you're achieving success or at least like getting closer 10% of the time, right? So it's just a big numbers game. So can you talk about that? Like what's that like for people who are listening to the show right now who maybe made one offer and got rejected? Can you talk to them at all or like anything that helps you kind of get through the hard times of getting rejected?
Yeah. So it's, it's patience. A lot of these deals, you got to fight for them and you got to just offer what you're comfortable with. If you're putting in a number because your incentive is to beat your competition, then, you may end up in trouble. I think generally speaking, you put in the offer you're comfortable with, you find exactly what you know and what you can do and then make the offer. It's a lot better to get 1 in 10 deals than to get 5 in 10 and then have 4 out of those 10 be deals you're going to spend, months or years and tens of thousands of dollars getting out of. I'm generally the opinion that if you have one loser deal, it's going to take at least three or four good deals to work your way out of that. And also your morale is going to be low because you're just, you're questioning your own ability. So
I love that. I guess
quick example on, just staying patient and hanging in there. I bought, my partner and I bought a 6-flat in Chicago just this year. It's not totally different strategy than our condo portfolio, which, is not our buying opportunity on those condos have pretty much been closed. The distressed market's done after the recession. So we're, I'm just looking for new strategies and new asset classes to buy. But, you know, back to staying patient, why there was a deal that was listed on the MLS, had an asking price, $595,000. My partner and I looked at it. It's very close to our office, six units. There are two retail units, four residential units, and one store was empty. One with there's like a local grocery store, and then the four apartments up top were in terrible shape, but, you know, nice size and good bones to the building. So it's for sale for $595,000. And, you know, we sat there, we toured it, we looked at it, we talked to the broker, and we said, listen, you're overpriced. I'm willing to give you $300,000. You can realize, think about the reaction I got, a 300 bid on a 595 ask. Yeah. It was sort of like, beat it, you know. Okay, so fast forward 6 months, they've lowered the price. They're down to, they've had a contract fall apart. They lower the price, $50,000. He says, hey, listen, you guys, you were in the initial group of interested parties, come tour it again. So we tour again, you know, $300,000, that's our number. So he says, no, sorry. Lower the price again. They're at 475-ish. We say, no, 300, that's it. So three contracts fall out. Then finally the broker calls back and says, okay, the deal's yours. Do you guys want it? And he said, yes. Okay, great. So 500 some days, the property's on the market by the time we got it. And, you know, it ended up working out. The deal, it needed a new roof. There was a gas tank in the backyard that required it to be dug up as an underground gas storage tank, which is typically a nightmare for most people. But we had a ton of time, so we were able to get a couple opinions that, hey, we can dig it up and get you all clean letter from the Illinois EPA within the next 3 to 4 months. And, you know, we had one store to rent and we've got four apartments to rehab. We're almost done stabilizing it. And I think we're going to, you know, our numbers are penciling out to being about a 13% cap rate. And it was a deal that sold in 2008 for $535,000. And it sold in 2002 for $495,000. And, you know, I think when we're all done, we'll be in at about $450,000. It'll be worth about $750,000 once we're stabilized. And then we'll be able to refinance all our capital out and just, you know, kind of hold it as a long-term investment, pay down debt. And love kind it. You know, practice old man real estate where you, you know, hang on to stuff for life and pay it off. So
Rob, one thing I want to call out about what you're doing here is like Brandon Turner talks all the time about the more tools you have in your tool belt, the more projects you can take on a rehab. So if all you have is a hammer, you can put in a loose nail, but you can't take out a screw. And if you don't have a saw, there's certain things you can't do. You described how you went from 1 to 300 units. And you mentioned several strategies that we talk about on Bigger Pockets to help people to kind of grow and to get into the game. And the first was the BRRRR strategy, the buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. You mentioned several times we bought a house at a very discounted rate, or not a house, a property, and then we made it worth more, and then we refinanced and got our money back. And that allows you to now go reinvest that same capital so that you can grow at a much faster rate than having to save up $40,000 for every condo you want to buy. You mentioned syndication. So you were gathering other people together and getting money from them and going and investing that money. You mentioned private money, which is kind of how you got started, friends and family. And then you talked about making several offers and you're just going to keep offering and offering. And I just want to highlight, that's how you go from 1 to 300, is you master all these tools that real estate investing provides. You combine them and you can scale really fast. Can you tell us a little bit about why you think you were successful raising money from your family for the listeners who want to do the same thing? And they don't really know where to start. They don't know what they need to say or how to propose this, what language to use. Can you share a little bit about tips you would recommend?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for starters, you can't really get 10% in any sort of CD or a non-stock market. Or if you get 10% in the stock market, you found a good investment guy anyways. But, you know, if you offer your friends and family, any sort of trusted person, say, hey, I'm going to pay you 10% interest. I'm going to give you a first position mortgage on the property as collateral. So, hey, listen, not only am I guaranteeing I'm going to pay you 10%, which is a large number. So that means I'm going to want to get you paid back as soon as possible. And if I don't pay you back, or if I get hit by a bus or something catastrophic happens, you can go foreclose the property and take it back and you'll be able to sell it and recoup all or very close to all of your money. So I think the downside risk is pretty low. There is a leap of faith to get some trust, but you know, you got to go to a close friend or family member, or if you can't, you don't have, you know, capital available, go find a real estate professional and that, you know, kind of mentor them and gain their trust so you can get a small loan.
Okay.
But I also think that when you've taken the time to perform the diligence and you've got the facts and you can clearly explain to somebody why it's a good deal and you haven't answered any sort of negative feedback that you get, you're going to exude confidence, and that's kind of what gets you the money. It's just, you know, be prepared. You have to know all the facts about what you're buying, why you're buying it, and just, you know, soak in as much of the public data as you can.
Yeah, confidence comes from preparation and education. And then that confidence is going to be how you win the people over when you're giving them an opportunity to invest with you. And that's what I wanted you to kind of highlight. The more you understand about this whole real estate investing thing, the more likely you are to have someone else that puts their trust and confidence with you and gives you money. And then you can go from one condo to 300. That's crazy. So tell us, okay, you scaled big. You did very, very well. I'm sure your portfolio has a ton of equity and cash flow is really strong. Can you kind of tell us, like, what are you doing now? What's the big picture of Rob's life? I know you're involved in more than just real estate investing. You wear many hats, and that's part of why you're successful, is you see this from many angles. Can you share with us the different hats you wear, what you've learned from each one, and how they all kind of play into this big scheme of what you put together now?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I love being an active real estate investor. Unfortunately, the market is not totally ripe for it right now. I think there's very little supply. I think there's a ton of cash on the streets that are looking for deals, and it's not impossible to buy. There are still great deals out there. It's just a little bit more competitive and it takes more time. So at the time being, I'm not pedal to the metal, but I am always looking at deals, and I'm practicing law. I'm a real estate attorney. And, you know, I focus a lot of time on managing and making our existing portfolio more efficient. Some of the ways you do that are by sharpening up your systems. I'm constantly updating them to deal with new laws that are coming out, or experiences that I've had that I think can streamline our tenant relations. So that's, you know, property management and practicing law are sort of what I'm most focused on at the moment.
So how do you do your property management? What's that look like? I mean, you're not out there swinging a hammer, fixing plumbing under a house, but are you taking phone calls? Do you have a property manager? What's that look like,
sure,
in your life?
Sure. I've got an excellent in-house property manager. Believe it or not, my business partner and I are both actively involved in property management, but we do have one gentleman who's our full-time property manager, works in our office every day, and he is sort of the front lines with, you know, taking calls from the tenants, doing leases, collecting rents, and dealing with all the rehabs. But for the most part, it's, you know, it sounds made up that you can have one employee to manage 300 units and not be, my partner and I don't have to do it full time. But the reality is, with technology today, it's amazing. We can DocuSign leases. I can collect rent payments via Venmo, Chase QuickPay, or ACH. We've got portals set up for placing repair calls or repair emails. And then we've got a very tight list of vendors for, you know, like I said, for rehabbing the inside of a condo unit, there's only a list of five or six things that can go wrong. So I've got two or three professionals in each sort of rehab category that I send for different tasks. So it becomes a very repetitive business.
Okay, Rob, what you're saying sounds too simple. I know that that may be the case, but I'm still scared. I still just feel like having 300 units would create so much liability that I could never grow that big. Can you tell me, if there is an answer out there, how I can feel comfortable enough to grow a portfolio that big without worrying about being sued, having my places burned down, having somebody throw a huge party in the condo and trash it? How can I know that this is a good idea?
Yeah, so first you better get a monster umbrella policy to back everything up, okay? Something that's adequate. Your insurance agent can always help with that and helps you sleep at night. You need to segregate liability with LLCs. So I've got, you know, different limited liability companies for, you know, not for each property, but, you know, I group them up, and depending on how I finance them or the asset size, you know, it's good to separate them. You don't want to have all your eggs in one basket, and you want to make sure you've got enough insurance. You know, on condos, the association assessment covers the majority of the insurance, which is for the building. But then I carry a rental policy for the inside contents. And I require the tenants also to get a renter's policy for their own personal property. So that alleviates things like, you know, hey, the unit upstairs flooded into mine, the pipe broke, or I was broken into and you didn't provide enough security, things like that. So, you know, you build insurance, you need to build the cost of your premiums into your underwriting models and just, you know, make sure that's taken care of. But otherwise, it's, you know, there's a lot of common sense. If someone emails you or calls you, get back to them. I mean, don't put it off, and, you know, just be responsive and be of service.
Okay. Is there anything that you can tell us specifically about the lease that kind of gave you, you know, confidence or a sense of security that, hey, I'm increasing my risk by increasing my size, but I'm also making steps to mitigate that risk?
Sure. So in Chicago, and I suspect it's the same case. I own almost all my property in Illinois. So I can't really speak to other states, but in Chicago, and I suspect it's most of the larger metropolitan areas of in the country, the laws are heavily slanted in favor of the tenant. Pretend that the person writing the laws or the legislators, they're under the assumption that each landlord is filthy rich. They own 5,000 apartments and they don't ever fix anything. They don't ever respond to a call. There's cockroaches all over the place. You know, so that's sort of what you're dealing with when you roll into court day one and the judge looks at you. He's got to follow the laws. You may not agree with them, but they are written to favor the little guy. And there is a reason for it. There was a reason for it, but it's not always fair. So, you know, if you don't have the correct lease or if you don't have the right disclosures in your lease or if you collect a security deposit, there are many different circumstances where you're coming into court and your tenant's 10 steps ahead of you. For example, in Chicago, there are a whole handful of tenants' rights attorneys that part of the court fee when you pay to file an eviction funds the tenants' attorneys. It's a nice service. It's necessary and it's good for social purposes. But when you're a landlord and you have a non-paying tenant and you haven't done anything wrong, you need to be in a position to protect yourself. In the city of Chicago, the biggest issue is security deposits. Believe it or not, I maybe have 3 or 4 security deposits on all 300 of my units. Those are tenants who haven't moved out since 2009 or 2010, and I therefore haven't had a reason to refund the security deposit, or they haven't accepted a refund when I'm offered it back to them. But for the most part, that's the biggest no-no in the city of Chicago. For any of my clients, I recommend not taking a deposit for the simple reason you have to hold it in a segregated account. You have to give them interest, which could amount to 12 cents a year. And you have to do it by a certain deadline. In the list goes on. There's probably 20 different things you have to do correctly. I'm an attorney and I would need a full-time, extra property manager or two just to figure out how to deal with secure deposits correctly in each circumstance. So, and the penalty, if you don't do that, is 3 times the security deposit plus the attorney fees for the tenant. It totally puts you behind the eight ball when you've got a non-paying tenant. Quick example, one of my clients comes into my office and says, hey, I've got a tenant. They're not paying rent. I need you to do an eviction. So I said, no problem. I gave them a notice. They came back a week later, said, hey, I gave them the notice. They still haven't paid. Why don't you go ahead and file? So basically, I'm walking into court. I know their lease is bad. There's nothing I can do about it. They've already broken all the security deposit violations. I didn't write the lease for them. They pulled it off of Google. And it maybe wasn't even written for the state. So it was a rough lease. So I'm hoping, okay, let's hope this tenant doesn't get a lawyer. Sure enough, lawyer shows up to court day one. I've got counterclaims. You didn't pay interest on your security deposit. And, we're coming after you. And by the way, my tenant's not leaving. Okay, so here's fast forward to the end of the case. I'm in court probably 5 or 6 times dealing with these tic-tac violations. It takes 6 months before the sheriff actually goes out and evicts this tenant. So it's $1,000 a month was what the rent was. No rent was paid for 6 months. So landlord's out 6 months for $6,000. I'm into them for $1,000 for court costs and fees. So that's $7,000. They had to pay the tenant's lawyer's fees. That's $8,000, another $1,000. And then there's a $100 penalty for the violations that they had. Now they're in, almost about $10,000. And tenant's just out. Place is trash. They've got to do turnover. Now, it's unbelievable because all of this is avoidable. Had the tenant done a correct lease on day one, not taken a security deposit, I could have gotten them out of court and probably or out of the unit in probably 6 to 8 weeks or negotiated with their lawyer to get rid of them because they'd have no leverage in court. And it's one of those things where it's like, hey, for 1 or 2 billable hours, you could have hired a lawyer on the front end. You never have to deal with this. And, this is not something that I see sometimes or on occasion. Invariably, 8 out of 10 clients that come in my office have a terrible lease. They've broken all the rules because it's sort of, everyone's intimidated to go talk to a lawyer on the front end. And it really, you meet a new person, you got a new advisor, the lawyer's going to want to do closings for you and do legal work. So, they're going to like to meet you as an investor. And for call it $500 or $600, you're going to have a bulletproof lease for whatever city you're in. So it's, in my opinion, a no-brainer. You got to get a tailored lease for your properties on the front end.
Yeah, I think the biggest mistakes I've made in my own career have been because I was trying to save money up front, like not using a property manager, for instance, when I was not in a position to do it myself. And then that led to a horrible eviction and lost rent and all kinds of problems because I didn't want to pay up front. I think having a lawyer in your corner is really, really valuable, even if for nothing more than just your own sense of confidence that comes from knowing, hey, I got big brother behind me flexing his muscles and he can take care of me when something goes wrong. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you would recommend for an investor to do? How does this whole process look to get a lawyer? Do you just start calling people and say, I need someone on standby? Is there an agreement you fill out? What does that look like?
No, I think it's just a referral. You know, if you've gone as far as to buy a property, you know, depending on what state you're in, you may have used a lawyer to buy the property, or you've probably worked with a real estate agent, either the listing broker or or if there was a broker who found it for you. So, you know, you've met a few people, you've gone that far, you know, ask around for recommendations. The other thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, in the past, what I've done is even though I am a lawyer, what I've done is I've hired other lawyers in my city who specialize in representing tenants and evictions. And I'll pay them $300-$500 to draft a lease for me. And it accomplishes two things. One, I see how they attack it from the tenant's perspective. And if there's other laws or angles that I haven't considered, even though I am a lawyer and understand generally how it works. And then two, the second best part is now I have an attorney-client relationship with that tenant lawyer. So if I have a tenant that I'm suing and this, you know, shark tenant lawyer tries to represent them, they've got a conflict of interest. So they have to back out of the case, or and the tenant has to find a new lawyer. So that's kind of a decent strategy too.
So me as an investor, do I want to call a lawyer and say, hey, I'm an investor, I need a lawyer, what can you do for me? Or is there specific questions that the listeners can know, hey, this is what I need to call a lawyer and ask him? How does that process work with when you're working with a lawyer before you're being sued?
Yeah, you want to get the lease done. You know, you want to, are you talking about like before you sign a lease? I think that's the best timing. And if you don't have direct access to the lawyer, you know, just don't go on Google and look it up. I mean, there's probably a lot of other trusted sites where you can buy tailored forms. And that's the next best thing. And if you are intimidated or don't want to spend the money, or your budget's too tight to hire a lawyer, then you can probably buy a custom tailored form from various sources online. And at least it'll be specialized to whatever state or city.
At Bigger Pockets, we actually just launched a bunch of like state specific legal forms. We went and partnered with a lawyer in, I don't know if partners, but we worked with a lawyer in every one of the states. I think we're at like 34 right now, and talked with that lawyer and said, hey, like, can you review this? Can you make it state specific, make it look good, as a way for our members who don't want to go to an attorney, who want to save some money, they can buy legal forms directly from Bigger Pockets. So it's kind of a new feature, just FYI, everyone. I think it's at biggerpockets.com/LL forms, like landlord LL forms. But so the legal thing, like, it's important. It is important, but it's also super intimidating. Like David said, like, yeah, I don't even know where to start most of the time. When I was starting with real estate, I was like, well, I'm broke, I'm poor, I can't go to a lawyer. That's going to charge me tens of thousands of dollars. Can you give us like a couple, like, if I were to book out an hour of your time or 2 hours of your time, like, and I'm just getting started with real estate, I'm just about to buy my first property, we'll go at the very beginning, what do I ask you? I mean, am I going, hey, can you, you know, give me a lease? Is that all I'm asking you? Or what else, what are you going to help me in that hour of time to do?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, and look, if you came into my office, I'd be billing it, I don't know, depending on what the matter is, somewhere between $250 and $300 an hour. And, you know, compare that to what you're going to spend at the title company on fees or brokerage fees or whatnot. It's not, if you have real questions, it's not, you know, really all that much money to sit on, and you can extract a lot of info in an hour. But yeah, you know, if someone came in my office and they said, hey, I'm a new investor, what should I do? I would help them in terms of structuring contracts when they're making offers and making sure they've got the right contingencies. You know, in Illinois, for example, there's an attorney review on most residential form contracts. So you sign an offer to buy something. If you know that there's an attorney review provision in there where once the seller accepts the contract, you've got, call it 5 or 7 business days for the lawyer to make modifications, then you can offer with confidence. And when there is a deal, you can start investing money into the deal at that point. And whether it be on the contract or preparing a lease or helping you research, you know, not everyone is experts at analyzing recorders' websites or, you know, the assessor's websites to determine what the taxable history is or how the taxes on the property will change. You know, to help underwriting, you know, a lot of the lawyers, once you do have a contract or once you do have a tenant you're looking for, the lawyers can help guide you through that process.
So that's so valuable what you just said right there. For people that may not understand the legal jargon, what you're saying is that you can go put a property under contract and have a contingency to back out based on the fact that your lawyer looked at this and didn't agree with the way that the contract was written or the condition of the property. That's so valuable for people that come across a deal and they want to buy it, but they just don't know what they don't know and they're afraid to pull that trigger. You go write your offer, you put it under contract. Then they call you or another lawyer and say, hey, I need you to look at this. Am I missing anything, right? Find the holes in this. And if the guy's saying, no, it's good to go, or the gal says it's good to go, you go back and show your agent, yep, let's stay in this thing and let's move forward. Brandon and I talk about that all the time is newer investors think that you take down a property with one swing of an axe, right? You better be sure before you swing that thing, you're getting into it. When in reality, it's like 30, 40, 50 very small steps that you take, and you don't take this one until you've already taken this one, right? The due diligence process does not have to be done all at one time. It's a process as you move through, and understanding the contract kind of is another tool in your tool belt. It lets me know I can go this far and I can still get out of this thing if I don't like it. So now I know I need to look at the next step. And I just love that you've dedicated yourself to understanding real estate, to being a lawyer, to working in title services, to being an investor, to managing a fund, all these things you're doing. You know what you can and can't get away with and how to navigate in this world. And that's why you have so much confidence. And I just want to stress to people that if you're feeling fear, you're feeling anxiety, it's probably a result of your own lack of education and knowledge, right? If you can gather more information and learn more about what you're doing, you will feel more confident. You'll put yourself in the arena more often and you get more victory. So, I mean, I listening to you talk, it just inspires me that, man, I want to go learn as much as I can. I want to have a tool belt that's just incredibly big, like Inspector Gadget, you know, running around with a tool for every situation that you could find. I love Brandon, do you have anything you want to add before we go to the fire round?
Nah, just that, like, you know, I want to just encourage people. Like, one of the mistakes I made early on was not going to a lawyer more often. You know, like I what I found is that lawyers are good for, I mean, obviously a lot of things. What I didn't realize that they were good for was like knowing the right questions to ask. So like recently I sat down with a lawyer when we bought our mobile home park out on in Bangor, Maine. And I sat down, Ryan Murdoch is one of my partners on the deal, and Mindy and Carl Jensen, who are the other ones, and lawyer, and I sat in this room. Well, Mindy and Carl were on a phone, and like the lawyer just asked us questions and after question, after question, after question, especially about partnerships, which technically it's not a partnership, but it's a tick. But anyway, because like we didn't even know the right questions to ask. Okay, he's asked things like, well, what are you going to do if one party does this? Oh, I don't know. I never even thought to ask that question. Or what are you going to do if this comes up? Oh, I don't know. I never thought about that. So like that hour we spent with that attorney will save us tens of thousands of dollars, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, potentially down the road. So again, my advice to people would just be like, don't be afraid of a lawyer, you know, but just go in there, you know, asking the right questions or asking the attorney, what are the right questions to ask? Anything you want to add to that, Rob?
Yeah. As David was saying, a lot of times you don't have to do anything until you have a contract that's accepted, because you're going to have certain due diligence, you know, clauses in the contract, inspection, attorney review, title review, whatever it is. You know, like I was saying in the beginning of the show, you know, I'd come in on Sundays with my partner. We'd make 100 offers sometimes in a day, and I hadn't looked at any of the properties. Now I did research the heck out of them on the front end. So I knew that I liked everything on paper, but I hadn't actually viewed the properties because it was crazy labor intensive. There's no way I could have done it. And, you know, I knew what the investment parameters were, but I hadn't actually inspected them. Okay. So fast forward a week or two after negotiating and going back and forth on counter offers, finally getting an accepted contract from a seller. And I'm saying, okay, cool. They accepted the deal. Now I've got 5 business days to go out and inspect these properties. So I'd go tour with my partner and my contractor, and then we'd figure it out. And sometimes we'd go back to the seller and say, listen, I didn't know that the furnace doesn't work. There's no way I could have known it because I didn't bring my furnace guy in there before the contract was signed. Now I need another $5,000 to fix this furnace. And most of the time they tell you to pound sand, but sometimes you get $1,500 or $2,000 and you may have already had some funds set aside or built into the deal for that purpose. So you don't always have to know everything before you actually get the deal. And there is actually time to research it. And sometimes if it doesn't pan out, you find something you don't like and the seller won't work with you, or if you want to cancel the deal, then you cancel it. You know, you don't have to bat 100% on your offers either. So if it was a 1 in 10, I got an accepted contract, there are probably 20% of those deals that I also canceled too. So it is a numbers game. And each deal that you cancel, you're going to have learned something. You canceled because you figured out, you know, there's something wrong. There was one condo I was trying to buy one time, And it was a bank owned property. I went in there with our inspector. It was a killer deal. It was $40,000 or $50,000 on Cicero Avenue in Chicago. It was in Skokie, Illinois, just outside Chicago. And the property was rehabbed. It was foreclosed. The lender was selling it. And when we went in there, you wouldn't believe this. The electrical outlets were screwed into the wall, and there was no electrical behind the outlet. The plumbing fixtures looked like they were there. And I went and turned the sink on as if there was a regular pedestal sink, and you'd open up the cabinet below and there was no plumbing fixtures in there. So it's like, this is a total fraud, and the bank that's selling it has never been there. They don't know. And it was like the craziest thing ever, but whatever. I was justified in canceling the contract. What am I going to do? I'm not doing an entire build out and putting in electrical and plumbing on a $40,000 condo, which is, sorry, next up, and I don't know what happened to that unit, but I wasn't prepared to do that much work. So
I've heard of stage furniture in a listing before. I've never heard of stage plumbing and stage electrical.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. That's like crazy. The Barbie dream home or something. They just bought, looked like a sink and plugged it in there.
Don't live there. You're going to go hang out on the couch and look around. Don't live there though.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned is you don't have to get a hit on every at bat, and you're 100% right. But what I found is that the more at bats you get, the smarter you get just from getting up there, right? You're seeing pitches, you're getting to know that pitcher, you're figuring them out. You may not be getting a hit, but you're getting closer to a hit with every at bat, and you're learning something, right? Because I buy house sight unseen all the time. I buy houses in different parts of the country, and everyone wants to know how I feel comfortable doing that. And the answer is just what we're saying is I'm not just committing completely the minute I write that contract to buy the house. That's a step in the direction of a purchase. Now I have a time frame that I've negotiated in that contract to go get an inspector to go. I don't need to go look at that house to make sure that the sink is actually plugged into plumbing. I need my house inspector to go do that and read his report, because he's going to find that much better than I would anyways, right? That sixplex that you mentioned that you bought, you had to dig out the gas tank, I believe. There's a lot of people that hear that and say, oh, I could never buy that. What if I didn't catch it? Well, your inspection would have caught that if you paid for one. So can you tell us a little bit about the last question before we go to the fire round? What's your future look like right now in real estate? You mentioned that you bought a sixplex. Are you focusing on multifamily? Are you waiting for a market correction? Like, what's Rob doing now?
Yeah, I'm actually looking at deals. Anything that makes sense. I would love to have another programmatic strategy like I did with the condos from like 2009 to 2015. And buy them or have some sort of strategy, in any asset class where I can sort of master one little niche and exploit it and build a system for it. It was one of those things where it's, if I had to go back and look at it again and I didn't have any hiccups or learning curves, I would have bought 3,000 condos. But that's, that's the equivalent of Back to the Future 2 where Biff gets the sports almanac, right? So... it's learn as you go type thing. I want to, find new deals that make sense, but I'm not rushing into them. I'm still making a lot of offers and I'm not getting many, but I'm hanging in there and I'm still trying to, get a lot of at bats. So, the other thing in terms of learning, it's not only when you're offering too, the learning curve is there on the property manager side. For as long as you're a property manager and as much experience you have, you're always going to learn some sort of angle or a way to make your, managing your properties better. I happen to self-manage because I think it's nice. I want to control the cash register. I want to know what's coming in and coming out. And I'm sort of the opinion that no one watches your money like you do, but there is something to be said about also having a huge scale of thousands of properties and having someone else manage it. And then you manage the manager. I'm not quite there. And, I don't have institutional type capital where I want to do that, but in terms of the management, I had my cousin called me about a month ago and said, "Hey, listen, I was just at her wedding. She got married and said, hey, my husband and I, we need to get out of the apartment we're in. We hate it. I'm ready to move. Can you help me get out of my lease?" And I'm thinking, okay, great. I hate representing tenants. I just, it's like kind of goes against what I do as a landlord. Yeah. However, I said, send me your lease. I'll take a look. So she's paying, in the city of Chicago. And there is the landlord filed absolutely none of the landlord tenant laws. So I'm looking at it saying, okay, if you want to sue your landlord, you've got the right to get about three times the security deposit plus my attorney fees. So I'm like, okay, it's 15 grand plus attorney fees. It's totally harsh and outrageous. The woman who owned her condominium that she was renting had owned it for like 20 some years. She'd never had a problem before and obviously didn't know about any of the laws because it was in, an old town in a nicer area of the city. But she still didn't know that, you've got to follow these security deposit rules. So you know, after a couple of conversations with her and her attorney, you know, they realized, okay, it's time to let them out of the lease. The tenant walks, they've got to do turnover. They got to find a new tenant. And it was a big learning lesson for them. I didn't, you know, my cousin, thank God, didn't want to sue them for that money. All she wanted to do was move, and she didn't want to exploit them or take advantage of them. But, you know, there's a ton of lawyers out there and that also have to make a living, and they view it as being, hey, it's the law, I'm going to enforce it. And the judges have no choice, they enforce it too. So, you know, we could have rolled into court and gotten a $15,000 judgment against this woman who's, you know, maybe invested 100 or 150 grand into her condo. So it's like, that's a catastrophic event. If you're a first time landlord and or a newer landlord or an uninformed landlord, you don't know about stuff like that. I mean, you can cruise by for a long time, but at some point in time, you can, you know, you can't always dodge every bullet. So this woman hopefully was, you know, became informed and won't make that mistake again. But it was, you know, wild situation. And unfortunately, I think there's probably a lot of municipalities in major like metropolitan areas in the country where you've got, you know, rent control and things like that exist. So it's, you know, kind of a harsh story, but good to realize why you can alleviate all that on the front end.
Yeah. So to kind of sum up, like, I think kind of what you're saying, like there are very severe laws. I mean, in every state, even tenant friendly states, I mean, landlord friendly states, there's laws everywhere that govern what we do. This is not the Wild West. Like there are like in most areas that it's governed pretty well. So if you're not willing to go and learn exactly what your landlord tenant laws are like, then you need to either hire a lawyer and have them consult with everything or hire a good property manager who can take that, but don't just wing it. Like this isn't a wing it kind of a game. Would you agree?
You could do it for maybe a short period of time, but to think that you're going to build a sustainable business without having the correct lease in lease forms and tenant forms is like beyond reckless.
Yep. Yeah, totally agree. Well, super, super cool. So now, before we get out of here, we're going to head over to the next segment of our show, which we lovingly refer to as our Fire Round.
Fire Round.
It's time for the Fire Round.
Listen up, business owners, because I've got some quick little math for you. Fewer costs equal more profit. The problem? You're spending more than ever on operations, materials, deliveries, software, and more. So why not reduce your costs and headaches with NetSuite by Oracle? NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Oh, also, NetSuite lives in the cloud, which means you can reduce IT costs with no hardware required. Cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. You can improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. It makes sense that over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. So don't let rising costs sink your business growth. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/biggerpockets. 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 Real estate investing is great, but for some, the tenant phone calls and clogged toilets aren't all that attractive. So how do you invest in real estate without getting your hands dirty? Invest for truly passive income with Pine Financial Group. Pine's mortgage fund offers a targeted 8% preferred return and an attractive profit split with 70% of net profits going to the investors. You'll earn passive income by participating in lending to house flippers. And it's secure because senior lien holders, that's you, are first in line to get paid. Their rigorous underwriting process and the backing of a physical asset mitigate downside risk. Plus, by investing with Pine Financial Group, you contribute to the revitalization of communities by directing your funds from Wall Street to Main Street and supporting local economies. The investment is reserved for accredited investors. Don't miss this opportunity to back Main Street over Wall Street and start earning passive real estate income. Learn more about investing with Pine at pinefinancialgroup.com/BP. pinefinancialgroup.com/BP. Deciding how to invest your capital can be extremely challenging, especially when the market is constantly changing. That's why it's never been more important to partner with a company that has a great track record. The BAM Capital executive team has successfully navigated through the Great Recession, COVID-19, and the current interest rate environment while delivering maximized returns to their partners. BAM Capital is a trusted multifamily syndicator with over $1.3 billion in transactions, delivering a historical average of over 35% IRR with an average hold period of 3.5 years. And BAM Capital has consistently paid preferred return distributions for over 50 consecutive months, has not lost limited partners capital, and has not called capital past the subscription amount. BAM Capital's disciplined investment strategy is targeting undermanaged institutional quality trophy assets throughout the U.S. heartland for accredited investors who are looking for generational wealth building or monthly income opportunities. Their offerings target cash flow stability, capital preservation, long-term appreciation, and accelerated tax benefits. Join BAM Capital's over 1,200 investors across 44 states and get started today at BAMCapital.com. Again, that's BAMCapital.com.
All right, let's get to the fire round. Now, these questions come direct out of the Bigger Pockets forums, and we're going to fire them at you, Rob. You ready for this? Can you handle it?
I'm ready. Right. Let's hear it.
Number one, appliances. What exactly is a landlord's responsibility to repair or replace? Now, specifically, I'm going to add a little bit. It was a long question, so I'll summarize. Basically, this woman owns a duplex, and for one of the units, when the tenants moved in, she supplied a washer and dryer, but this because it was there when she bought the property. Well, now the washer or dryer broke. Does she have to fix the washer and dryer? It's not anywhere in the lease. So what does she do? Can she just say, hey, sorry, well, now you got to go get your own? Or does she have to supply a new one now because it was there when the tenants moved in? What do you think?
Yeah, so it depends what the lease says. If the lease says it doesn't include a washer and dryer and one happens to be there, then there's an argument that you don't have to fix it. But the most common circumstance you'll see this in is like window air conditioning units. You can say property comes with no air conditioning unit. If there happens to be one there, I'm not liable for it. However, if it's unclear in the lease and it doesn't specifically state that the tenant's liable for it, then it's going to fall on the landlord to fix or replace it.
All right. Good answer.
All right. Okay, the next question is about going from a year contract to a month-to-month lease. So this forum guest says they have good tenants whose lease is up for renewal soon, and the tenants want a month-to-month situation. The landlord's instinct is to say no, they want to insist on a full year renewal, even if it means losing them as tenants. They don't like the idea of going month-to-month lease because the tenants can leave during a time when it would be hard to put a new tenant in the property. What are your thoughts on this? Do you have any experiences going through something like this, and how would you advise someone to handle it?
Sure. So there's a couple factors that go into it. Most important in Chicago is seasonal. Leases that expire in December, January, or February will have the longest vacancy period. So if someone says in the middle of December, hey, I need one more month, my lease is up 12/31, I need till 1/31, yes, no problem. In the middle of the summer, spring, fall, when the lease up period's good, I customarily will not do it unless there's some special circumstance. And if the tenant wants the flexibility to have a termination or termination option within like a short horizon, they need to pay a temporary rent bump. You know, if there's a good reason, hey, I'm waiting for a job, I'm not going to renew a 1 year lease, then you can say, great, you have a 7.5% rent bump while you're month to month. That way you get some compensation for the lack of stability. The other thing you can do is you can build into your lease agreement that says, sometimes Illinois law provides it if the tenant is able to find, or at least Chicago law, if the tenant's able to find a suitable sublessor, then you've got no choice. But suitable means, you run credit, they've got good enough income, they can sustain the rent payment, they don't have a criminal history, things like that. Usually the tenants won't go through all the steps to do that. So, but that's an option. The other option is a buyout. I've gotten all our leases. If you want to terminate mid-lease, it's 3 months upfront. And you pay it, you prepay 3 months rent, and then I terminate it. And it sounds like it's a windfall to the landlord, but when you think about it, it's not entirely, because you're going to have some turnover costs, minor paint, minor fix up. If you've got to have a realtor re-let your place, you're going to usually pay a half a month or a month commission, and then you've got you're sort of specking the risk for whatever vacancy might exist. So I think it does compensate you adequately in like an efficient market, but if you're in a time period when, the economy's bad or you can't rent really quickly, you may want to reconsider that. But from my experience in Chicago, the 3 month lease buyout's been pretty good.
All right. I like that actually a lot. I think that's cool. Sort of compromise there. All right. Next one. I purchased my first rental property at the end of December. It was a foreclosure and I purchased it from the bank with cash. Now, after the closing, I received a credit for the sanitation bill. But now 2 months later, I'm receiving a water and sewer bill that starts from way back in October. How did that happen? I had a realtor, I had a lawyer, I had a title company. Now what do I do? Who's responsible for that?
Call the lawyer. I mean, your contract said they're supposed to have real estate tax prorations. The lawyer's in charge of seeing that that all the conditions of the contract were performed at the closing. Unfortunately, a lot of contracts have a merger clause, which says once the deed is received, that all the pre-closing conditions have deemed to have been agreed upon and satisfied. So, you know, while you can, there's a possibility that you'll get a seller that is cooperative in a bank-owned REO situation. You know, I think your requests will probably fall on deaf ears. So if I was in that person's shoes, I'd call the lawyer and say, well, you know, hey, here's my bill. Why didn't I get the proration? And maybe the lawyer's not going to write you a check to cover, you know, whatever the loss was, but maybe you can work out a deal. Hey, on the next time I have some sort of legal work, you'll give me this much credit off my bill or, you know, something along those lines.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
It's very good.
But also it's, you know, kind of, you got to get the big picture too. Unless it's an astronomical bill, it's, you know, you bought a foreclosure, there's going to be some expenses. And, you know, it sounds like the big picture, everything was good. And, you know, you have one little issue. So you got to kind of, there's always going to be little hiccups in the deals. You got to keep them forward too.
That is fantastic advice. Yeah, there's always things that are going to go wrong. Like people are always, I don't want to invest in real estate because something might go wrong. Well, yeah, something will go wrong. Like, you know, you deal with it.
I mean, hey, look, it works. It cuts both ways. Sometimes you do a closing and the seller says, hey, this tenant has not been paying. So you say, okay, no problem. I'll assume the risk. I'll evict the tenant. And I mean, hopefully you're getting the right price on the building where it's worthwhile to assume, you know, the task of dealing with that. But, you know, I've had times where the tenant comes into our office, you know, 2-3 weeks later and says, oh, here's my $5,000 back rent. I just got my tax return and I'm sorry I couldn't pay it. So, you know, there's situations when you come up to, and, you know, it works both ways.
Yeah, nobody complains when that happens.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You don't hear those stories. Real estate is horrible. I got more money than I expected to get. This is ridiculous. Right. I don't know if it's going to happen. Yeah, right. We definitely tend to focus on negative and that becomes an excuse not to go. And when the positives happen, we just assume it should have happened that way. So that's a really good point. It does cut both ways. And training yourself to recognize that is a good way to kind of keep your own confidence levels high. All right, Rob, last question. I'm asking for a friend. What is the best way to invest $500,000? Good friend of mine owns 2 units for the past 15 years. The stock market is leveling out and will not be as exciting as last year. So he's looking for a new way. What do you think or recommend would bring the safest ROI?
I guess it's sort of a loaded question. It depends where you're at. You know, it's different in different areas of the country and what you're used to. If you're not a seasoned, you know, real estate professional and you're not going to do all the research, study the data, like we talked about throughout the show, and really, you know, immerse yourself and have some other sort of real estate expertise and stay involved and active with it, then you should invest in a passive fund. You know, you can find REITs or institutional funds that will take your money and have good track records and give you a good return, whether it's, you know, you're investing in a limited partnership interest or, you know, publicly traded REIT. It's sort of whatever your flavor is. But $500,000, you can do some damage. I mean, that can be a down payment on a pretty big building. So, you know, if you want to manage it yourself and jump into the arena, $500,000 is a lot to play with. So, study the data and make 10 offers and hope you get one. Right.
There you go.
Rob, what do you think? What do you think about the investment strategy of watching Billions on HBO and copying whatever Bobby Axelrod does?
Yeah, that guy's he's good. It was a big learning curve switching from Homeland to Billions, but I mean, he's pretty good. I think he bought up all the bonds in the one city and then foreclosed all the real estate and basically took down the government. I mean, it's totally wild.
I was watching an episode last night and there's some tsunami that came because of an earthquake and they're like, the person running the fund was expected to have seen that coming and known what to do.
It's a good show. It's interesting though. I mean, there's people in Chicago that sort of play that strategy that, hey, I've got enough money. I'm going to buy the market. You know, there's a couple landlords that own, you know, thousands of units and they say, hey, I can't really get the return. I don't see the yield anywhere else. I've got this big, you know, platform built already. If I add another 500 units to it, it's no big deal. And there's nowhere else I know that I've got a patient enough, long-term enough expert strategy where I'm going to clip 5% a year or 5.5% a year. So they'll buy deals that, you know, the general market considers to be overpriced. But if it's in the location where they already manage other property and getting more scale does good for them, then it, you know, each deal, like I said, each deal kind of is different for each investor, and some deals make sense for some people and they don't make sense for other people. So at the end of the day, you got to know why you're comfortable buying whatever asset you're going to buy, and you have to have sort of a strategy and stick with it.
Yeah, I love that.
So today's quick tip, don't bother learning real estate when Bitcoin lets you down. Just copy what they do in the show Billions and you can.
Yeah. Don't work for Bobby Axelrod.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Moving on to the last segment of the show, which we lovingly refer to as our famous four.
Ooh.
Yeah. Way to go. Way to screw that one up, DG.
I did.
But before we get to today's famous four, let's hear a quick word from Mindy on what's going on this week over on the Bigger Pockets Money podcast.
Thanks, Brandon. On this week's episode of the Bigger Pockets Money podcast, we chat with Alan Donegan. Alan watched and helped his father run a super successful sportswear company until the economy shifted and they lost everything. Determined not to follow this path, Alan got a job. Then another and another. And another, he couldn't find anything he wanted to do. So he created his own job, teaching people how to create theirs. Taking lessons from his father's experiences, Alan teaches entrepreneurs how to start really small and test the idea before jumping in with both feet. If you have an entrepreneurial itch, this is a can't miss episode. Okay, and now for the famous four.
Famous four.
All right, so let's get to the famous four. These are the same four questions we ask every guest every single week. We're going to throw them at you, Rob. So number one, do you have a favorite real estate, specifically real estate related book?
Yeah, so I liked Rich Dad, Poor Dad a lot. And then I think the follow-up book was like The Cash Flow Quadrant. Yep. And I guess it's not like deals specific to real estate, and it's sort of doesn't analyze all the real estate deals and not totally real estate focused, but I thought it was really helpful for me because it helped analyze the tax perspective of being a business owner versus self-employed versus an employee. And at some point in time, I think that, you know, in everyone's career, if you can get to the self-employed or the business owner phase, the tax consequences or the tax benefits are insane, right? You can run a lot of your life through your business because you have, you know, you're using your car for business, you're using your phone for business. If you work at a company, you may have a phone or have a car, but if you don't, you're buying all that stuff with post-tax dollars. So I thought that was a pretty cool takeaway and kind of showed me, you know, the way real estate can help you get there.
Very nice. Awesome. You wear many business hats, Rob. What is your favorite business book?
There's a book called, I like kind of true stories and biographies. So there's a book that I read that kind of had a good impression. It was a biography on Jesse Livermore. I think it was called The Greatest Trader Who Ever Lived. And, you know, it's not exactly related to real estate. Well, I guess not at all, but it was about a guy from the Great Depression area. You know, he started off as like a little kid working in trading shops and became, you know, the biggest short seller ever. He was the guy that was short the market when the Great Depression stock market plunge happened and, you know, became like one of the richest guys in the US. And he was just someone who had very little formal education and, you know, became immersed in his market, figured out his skill and exploited it as best as he could and sort of, you know, found out ways to make value as a trader. I thought it was pretty cool to show someone who, you know, came full circle from walking in the door as like, you know, the 10 or 12 year old kid, you know, sweeping the floors to becoming the guy who, I guess there were no jets in the 1930s, but maybe limousines or whatever he had.
Awesome. He had the nicest horse-drawn carriage.
Yeah, yeah. Killer Clydesdales pulling them around.
I always love those stories, you know, the rags to riches. And I wonder who the next listener of the Bigger Pockets podcast is going to be that, like, you know, what they're hearing, just it scratches that itch that they need to scratch. And then they become, you know, very, very wealthy and go on to be really successful because it could come from anywhere. And it's so cool when it does. Can you tell us a couple of your hobbies? What do you like to do when you're not representing people and evicting people and all the fun stuff you're doing in real estate?
Yeah. So I play a lot of golf in Chicago. You get like 5 months a year. So I try to do that as much as possible. Early
Wait,
mornings.
a lawyer playing golf. Come on. Really? Yeah. That happened?
Hey, it's good though for real estate. A lot of times you get involved with deals. You want to have partners or you need to have partners. Yep. Someone has the deal, someone has the money, or you both, you know, have a reason why you need to be partners. Golfing's pretty good. You get 4 or 5 hours to hang out with someone. You know, you can kind of judge character, analyze if it's someone you want to be partners with. once you get into a deal, you're going to be in usually for years. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, picking a good partner. You get to vet them out pretty good. You need, you know, it's better than going to 10 dinners with someone. So
I totally agree.
I was in Hawaii, Brandon was like, David, when are you going to learn how to golf? I'd never want to learn how to golf. It looks so boring. And he's like, no, you need to learn how to golf if you want to be a good business person. Your game will step up huge. And like every good business person says what you just said. It's like, I can't get someone to come in for 4 hours and interview them, but I can go hang out and play golf with them when they don't know they're being interviewed and find out everything I would ever need to know. So
yeah, get a few beers in them and you get a lot of disclosure comes out.
That you do. All right. So. What do you believe? So my last question on the Famous Four, what do you believe sets apart successful real estate investors from all those who give up or they fail or they never get started?
Yeah, I think it's patience. You know, you can't exactly time what you're getting into. When you wake up and say, okay, today's the day I'm going to go look at a property or buy a property, you know, at that point in time, you probably know nothing about where the market was, where it is today, and kind of where it's trending towards. Obviously you have to get your feet wet and there is risk involved. And, you know, you do need to take risk when you buy that first property but you know, you also don't have to rush into it. You can be patient and figure out when is the correct timing. So just because you woke up and said, hey, I'm ready to buy today, you don't have to actually buy today. You just need to start your process today and carry on your process until you do actually buy.
Very nice. Rob, where can we find out more about you?
Jeez, to be honest with you, I'm sort of embarrassed, but I don't even operate. We don't have a website. We don't, you know, a public website. So it's, you know, I think my email information's on with Mindy on the show. But apart from that, I'm not, you know, we're not incredibly public with all our information.
Are you taking more clients if people in Chicago area want to use you?
Yeah. We're interested in clients. It's our law firm's called Beaulieu Law Offices. It's Beaulieu, B as in boy, Eaulieu. And you can find us at beaulegal.com. And, you know, our information and attorney profiles are on there. So if you want to, you know, reach out or whatever, we'd be happy to discuss anything you've got on your mind.
Perfect. And we will link to that on the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show275. So Rob, thank you so much. It's been awesome. Super informational. I love hearing your story. I just think it's crazy. You went from, you know, 0 to 300 condos, just like, you know, we just did it. Not a big deal. So I think that's awesome. So thank you for telling us your story today.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it, guys.
All right. Thanks. See you around.
Okay. Have a good one.
All right. And that was our show with Rob Oliver, attorney at large. Is that what they call him? I don't know.
That's what you call
attorney
him.
At law. Attorney at law, not large.
Attorney at large would be the kind of guy I would have been arresting in my previous career. That's funny. Attorney at large.
Oh man, we should re-record that, but we're not going to. That's funny. Anyway, super cool show and super important lesson. Like, you know, like I said in the show, like this is not like a flippant, like just go and buy some real estate. Like there are legal consequences to what we're doing here, which is why most people will never get into it. So, you know, get the right advice, get the right attorney, go out there and make some deals happen.
Yep. And try to find an attorney that invests themselves. That's so cool, right? Like I'd trust whatever Rob told me because he's got 300 condos. He's done this himself. So when you're looking for an agent, when you're looking for a property manager, when you're looking for a contractor, all the pieces you're going to need, a lawyer, find one that same perspective we are. And it'll be the advice that they're giving you will be much more tailored to kind of what you're doing.
There you go. Rock solid. Well, hey, I know you like analogies, David, so I'm going to give you an analogy. So I was watching, my wife and I are rewatching Lost right now. You know the show Lost, right?
Oh, so, yeah. You guys tried to suck me into watching that.
That's right. So you haven't seen Lost yet. You got to get there.
No, I don't do drugs and I'm afraid to get it.
All right. So we're rewatching Lost, probably because I talked to you about it and I was like re-sparked to watch it. So anyway, we're watching from the beginning and there's an analogy that Mr. John Locke, who doesn't mean anything to you, but he's shaven head like you. And John Locke gives us a great analogy. He points out this butterfly, like a moth. There's like a moth in a cocoon and he points it out and he goes over to it and he says, you know, this right now, this moth is inside here, you know, this caterpillar, or whatever it was. I don't know what a pre-moth is, but whatever that is, there's a pre-moth inside this cocoon. Right. And he's struggling and fighting right now to get free of this cocoon, and he's tearing at the stuff, and it's going to take him a few days to get through it. And by the time he does, he'll rip open that thing and he'll fly out. Now I could, and he's got this big, huge hunting knife in his hand. He's like, I could go over here and just very carefully create a little line here and free the moth from his cocoon, and he'll not have to struggle at all. He'll just come out. But if I do that, he'll die. He won't be able to survive because the cocoon is what gives him his strength. The struggle is what gives him his strength. Anyway, so I was watching that and I was like, that is such a good analogy for just life, right? Like, this is hard sometimes, real estate investing, or just like, you know, like trying to build any kind of business entrepreneurial thing. But that's what gives us strength later on in life. So I thought you'd appreciate that little analogy for a non-Lost fan.
It's like, that's my favorite analogy, I think, in the whole world. I usually say it with a little baby chicken trying to get out of the egg. Very same thing. Yeah. But yeah, like when you're feeling pain, when you're feeling struggle, know that that's for a purpose because it's making you stronger to accomplish your goal. It doesn't mean you're doing the wrong thing because it's hard. Too many people quit because it didn't come easy and they think that's a sign that they're not supposed to be doing it. I'd say the opposite. If it's coming easy, then there's nothing for you to gain there. The struggle is, you know, what is what the goal is, because that's what's going to make you stronger. That is, I'm very impressed. I don't think I've ever been as proud of someone as Brandon finally embracing an analogy. I feel like my little boy just took his first step.
I love analogies. I just make fun of you for being like the king of analogies. You're the best person I've ever known at analogies. Like, you just come up with an analogy off the top of your head. Like right now, give me an analogy. Go.
Okay. You telling me that I'm the best person you've ever known at giving analogies is like Tiger Woods saying that's the best putter that I've ever met, right? Like, you're very good at it yourself. So that's a huge compliment coming from you.
Okay. Well, that was a good analogy. Very, very well. Right off the cuff. All right. Thank you guys for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoy it. And if you have not yet left us a rating or review in iTunes, please do so. We'll give you a nice big bear hug next time we hang out. So with that, let's get out of here. DG, anything you want to end the show with?
No, sir. This is David Green for Brandon Investor at Large Turner signing off.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com, your home for real estate investing online.
The market is changing and finding your way can be tricky. Rates shift, headlines whirl, but your goal hasn't changed. You want financial freedom. And the best investors know it's not about timing the market, it's about time in the market. If you're ready to get into the real estate investing game or take your game to the next level, finding an investor-friendly agent is your next step. With BiggerPockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in minutes. Just head to biggerpockets.com/deals and enter a few details about what and where you want to buy, and bam! Instantly match with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only. Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.